Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Everyone's right and no one is sorry. That's the start and the end of the story. From the sharks and the jets to the call in the morning.
Greetings, my name is Benjamin Jacobs, your host as we travel towards Wittenberg and Westphalia, Wars of the Reformation. This is episode 95, Source Tags and Codes. Hello, folks. It has been a while, and it is honestly going to be a bit of a while more, I'm afraid, before we get to the main narrative episodes. Instead, today I'm going to be discussing historiography and sources. Partly, as you will see, this is because we have a lot to talk about here, and partly this is a bit of an amuse-bouche to tide you fine folks over while I read all these sources. I'm going to finish up with a bit of an explanation for the delay. Now then, as we start discussion of the investiture controversy, we have crossed a number of thresholds in historiography that are really quite noteworthy. For most of the show thus far, a lot of the work that went into the show involved dealing with the fact that we only had 1 to 3 sources at any given time, all secondary accounts by monks whose main goals were either chronicling what happened at their particular monastery, or else involved representing the viewpoint of one particular patron. True primary sources, like peace treaties, legal records, diaries, and things like that, have been thin on the ground. All that changes from here on out, and it changes for a very specific reason. The investiture controversy pits 2 or possibly 3 powers against each other, and those powers were directly involved in patronizing monastic communities. As such, the resources of those communities would be mobilized for the conflict. This did, in fact, often involve literal armies of knights who were vassals of the communities, but perhaps just as useful to those in charge were the scribes. Letter writing between communities and the literate members of the European society were conducted to sway opinions, all of which would slowly develop into the Western world's first real propaganda war. And because, as we will see eventually, the conflict doesn't have a very clean ending, the topics of discussion raised by these propagandistic efforts were never really resolved and in some ways remain relevant down to the present. No side was able to claim their arguments were supreme, and as such, the memory of the events became contested territory, with all sides wanting their version of events documented. As such, more letters survive, more chronicles were produced, and in general, a historian, even an amateur one, is spoiled for the riches of the sources preserved. Indeed, it is somewhat bewildering. I kind of feel like the protagonist of an M. Night Shyamalan movie who had seemed to be living in an era of superstition and faith and then suddenly stumbles into a more modern era. Podcast footnote. For rhetorical purposes, I put the emphasis here on the ideological importance of these documents, but there is something else going on, probably. There is undoubtedly an actual term for this. If there are any archaeologists out there, please get in touch. But for any given material in a given environment, there's going to be a horizon of survivability. Which is to say that for a document written on parchment and stored in Europe, there will eventually come a time where the parchment itself just physically disintegrates. Even leaving aside other forms of attrition like fire and vandalism, at some point, everything degrades to the point of being lost if it's not copied. This is a known source of distortion, and I hope it's not an entirely unfamiliar concept to you, my intelligent and attractive audience. But I think the true ramifications of this are often not really taken on board by people. Like, we have a bunch of written records from the ancient civilizations of Mesopotamia and Egypt, but that is because they have very good weather, and because a lot of what they produced was written on stone or clay tablets. The medium also distorts what we think we know about these civilizations. Mesopotamia had kiln-fired clay tablets widely available, and so we have a ton of business records from Mesopotamia, because small clay tablets can be used for that kind of thing, and they essentially last indefinitely. In Egypt, where everyone wrote on papyrus, most of what we have for the earlier eras is only in the form of stone carvings on monuments. All the business records were lost. So Mesopotamia comes off as a bunch of nerds talking about shipments of sheep, while Egypt seems like a bunch of heroic god-king jocks, but that's just because of the medium of writing and what survived. For Roman records, there's an assumption that Rome produced more written material than the cultures that followed after the fall of the empire, because we have so many documents from Rome. But none of these documents are original, and very few are primary sources. Things survived because they were copied, and only if they were copied. So Roman literature did not necessarily survive because there was more of it, or it was better, but because the people who lived between now and late antiquity found it more interesting, or they liked the prose more, or because it served a function as a teaching aid. Like, anyone out there who considers themselves a fan of Greek philosophy, what we have of Plato and Aristotle only survived because they were basically philosophy for dummies. They talk about a lot of things, so they're relevant, and they're relatively easy to read if you know ancient Greek. The stuff we have from Aristotle wasn't even intended as literature. It's probably his lecture notes that his students copied or recopied for use in the school he founded. We know from other references that he did write books, and they were well-regarded stylistically, but those weren't as useful for students as this sort of dense, bullet-pointed sequence of his lectures. So now all we have are these kind of clunky technical lecture notes, which have a lot of value for space, I guess. Meanwhile, it's pretty clear from what he wrote that Plato didn't actually rate writing as a good way to grasp philosophy. He thought you needed to either be born with it or learn it through actual discussions. So when he wrote stuff down in the form of the dialogues, they were intended as, you know, simple plays that can hold the attention of young students and will present a variety of points of view on a topic without needing to necessarily come to a firm conclusion. Basically, this is like if the only historical works that survived from our era were the oversimplified videos on YouTube, or the horrible histories, or if all of our knowledge of science was preserved by a VHS copy of Carl Sagan's Cosmos. My point here is that we have just crossed an invisible historical threshold of many kinds. We've gotten to the point where the original parchment documents can physically survive in a European climate entirely by accident. Not a lot of them, but some. As we go forward, we will find more and more random bits of evidence that just got shoved in a corner and forgotten. Of course, documents that are interesting will always have a leg up on those that aren't, so this distortion is going to continue to be an issue we need to consider. A lot of the documents that do survive are like land records from churches. The fact that the institution of the church continued to survive made those legal documents relevant, and so they were preserved. And so, you know, that is a form of distortion. The other thing that could happen is that maybe no one even thought they were relevant anymore, but because the physical abbey itself still survived, no one went back and cleaned out the archives. In any case, that's the main thing I was saying in the main episode text, that the material from this era remained relevant for centuries after its creation, and so copies were made. But at the same time, we do also finally start seeing original documents as well, and that's very exciting. End podcast footnote. Now, in general, I don't often have the time to track down the primary sources, even in the past when we've had, like, just a less than a handful. That's all the more so true now. There's issues with translation into English, translations that don't exist, or if they do exist, they're extremely expensive, and just from a time standpoint, I'm not going to track down every single thing that exists, because this isn't an academic podcast. But even in my reliance on secondary and semi-secondary sources, this era represents an explosion of material. Because the investiture controversy is still a major topic of study and debate among historians, theologians, philosophers, political scientists, and yes, even podcasters, my works consulted here is large, larger than it usually is, but it's also far from comprehensive. There is so much material out there about this time period that I basically focused on addressing story structure rather than comprehensiveness. Which is to say, for a general overview, I worked with the sources that I have already discussed in this show, like the history of the medieval church and the Oxford history of the Middle Ages that I've mentioned previously. The Pope's Army is still here, though I really have to admit that book is pretty basic. Sadly, my collected works of Chris Wickham kind of sunset before the investiture controversy, so let's all say goodbye to Chris Wickham. Bye. Bye, Chris. In any case, with a basic grasp of the background and some of the controversies, I knew I needed perspective on the key players. And so I tracked down biographies of those individuals, at least one each. I probably could have done a little bit better in finding well-regarded biographies on some of them, but this is what I got, and this is what I'm working with. These biographies being The Life and Times of Hildebrand, Pope Gregory VII, by Arnold Harris Matthew, Henry VII of Germany, 1056-1106, by I.S. Robinson, Tuscan Countess, by Michelle Spike, and The Military Leadership of Matilda of Canossa, 1046-1115, by David Hay. Of these four books, The Life and Times of Hildebrand is a fascinating little weirdo. It was written by Arnold Harris Matthew, a man who claimed to be the third Earl Landaff, due to a claim involving his father allegedly being born 5 months after his alleged parents' wedding, and then being raised in the countryside to avoid the scandal. This story was not accepted by the courts of England when Matthew attempted to assert his rights over his ancestral lands and titles. Matthew would go on to be ordained a Catholic priest, and then renounce his faith, eventually drifting into the Church of England, then back towards Roman Catholicism. Then he was attracted to the Old Catholic Church of Utrecht, which is a long story in itself, suffice it to say, they were refugees from Vatican I. He was ordained a bishop by that communion, and claimed to lead the Old Catholic Church of the United Kingdom. He was unsurprisingly excommunicated by the Roman Catholic Church, but he was also then excommunicated by the Old Catholic Church of Utrecht. And while the Church of England never explicitly excommunicated him, they also never let him near any kind of priestly role, though he tried repeatedly to get them to do so. In the midst of a lifetime of trying to prove himself to be special, Matthew also wrote at least four books, possibly as many as six. Two are history books, notably this one, and one about Rodrigo Borgia, with the others being works of theology. The edition of the book that I have was published by an old Catholic organization in the United States, the Society of Mercy. The Society set up the St. Gabriel Theological Press via a self-publishing website, and they publish works of religious significance to the old Catholic denominations that also happen to be in the public domain. In the editor's note, it is claimed that this book has stood the test of time for over 100 years for its scholarly research and insight. Needless to say, when I realized what I had bought, I was dubious. Despite all the red flags, I have to give Matthew credit. The book is pretty good for what it is. It's extremely readable, which is always a relief and is a huge contrast to the biography of Henry IV, which we'll talk about in a second. And the stances Matthew takes on the controversies of the story do actually remain relatively mainstream. They're not completely out of left field. He supports his arguments with evidence from primary sources, and I'll even give him credit for presenting the viewpoint of multiple sources and then explaining his reading. Say what you will about the guy, I found reading this to be valuable, and I appreciate the transparency of his scholarship. That said, the book was published in 1910. There's a lot missing from modern interpretations of the events, and just in general. If you're looking to base your worldview of the investiture controversy on one book, it would really be quite dangerous to rely on one 100-year-old book. According to Google Scholar, this book is very rarely cited in modern literature, and in fact most of the citations are from the 1960s. And an unsettling number of citations are from papers that were not actually about history, like if it might be a science paper that wants to reference something about the investiture controversy. So the people who are referencing it weren't even historians. Whatever the feelings of the old Catholic community, and no matter how readable this book is, the academic consensus seems to not be particularly favorable and likely for good reasons. So, you know, not the first one I would go to, but I had fun reading it. More relevant is the biography of Henry IV by Robinson. Thoroughly researched and comprehensive, this book is well-regarded and rather dense. I have made three attempts to plow through this book, and while discontinuing it had a bunch of outside influences, and it's not, like, deadly, if there is a single reason for the episode delays, it's the slow pace of this book. Nonetheless, it is an invaluable source of modern scholarship on the topic in one volume, which is really important given my needs for efficiency. At the time of recording, I have not yet finished the books on Matilda of Canossa, so I will update these in the next couple of episodes as I read them. With the biographical and chronological perspective secured that I wanted, I also wanted to investigate the wider cultural impacts of these events and try and flesh out the skeleton of the story with some color from the period. The historiographical story here is as important, if not more so, than the specific political and military maneuvers conducted by both sides. So I secured a few source books that would help me out with this. notably Power and the Holy in the Age of the Investiture Conflict, A Brief History with Documents by Maureen Miller, Imperial Lives and Letters of the 11th Century by Theodore Mommsen and Carl Morrison, and Foundations of the Consular Theory by Brian Tierney. Again, I still have to do more reading on these sources, but I do want to highlight the theoretical contributions of Dr. Miller. Her framing of the power and the holy has been absolutely invaluable as I have prepared my research on this topic. There will be an extended discussion of her ideas when we get to the end of this series of episodes. The fact that she made this contribution in the introduction to one of the shortest books I consulted speaks to the clarity and correctness of her ideas, and I hope you'll find them as invaluable as I did. If there's one volume you look into for further clarification of this era, grab that one, though you probably want, you know, more than one. Now, I should talk a bit about source books. These books compile English language translations of primary source documents for use by students in introductory courses. Academic historians are rightly suspicious of them when using them as research sources, because they have editorial biases that come from such a presentation. Why include this document and not that one? It's a choice that's made by the editor and not necessarily by history. Do we know anything about the translation choices made, etc.? These things can be kind of opaque. However, for my purposes, these concerns are secondary to the efficiency such compilations provide to someone who speaks only English and has no affiliation with academia. Sourcebooks are just a really efficient and very valuable source of primary source documents and sort of the feeling of an era, and they've always been invaluable for me. And the more of them I find, the happier I am. Also, having more of them is going to reduce the source bias of any one editor. Finally, I must admit to using a podcast as a source, which would normally be a big no-no. We podcasters do our best, but we are usually tertiary sources at best. However, as I have said, the impact of this controversy was as much in the world of ideas as in politics or military matters, or economic impacts, and there's one podcast out there which is focused specifically on the history of ideas, and where the standard of research is so high that I just don't mind using it as a source. This is The Unimpeachable History of Philosophy Without Any Gaps by Peter Adamson. Peter is a lecturer in philosophy at the LMU in Munich, and so he has access to academic resources that I don't have. As he's gone through the entire history of philosophy, he's been working with the Oxford University Press to turn his scripts into actual introductory-level textbooks for students to use at the university level. While I didn't get my hands on a physical copy of those books for the period under discussion here, I think that if the basic material is good enough for the Oxford University Press, it's probably good enough for you fine folks as well. So, as I go through this stuff, I'm going to be dipping into his archive to refresh myself on things like the Scholastic Philosophers and the various debates that sprung up around the investiture controversy from that point of view. Okay, so that's it for the sources section. Now, I owe you all explanations. First of all, thank you for your patience during this period of very irregular episodes. Part of the explanation for this irregularity is that we're still just recovering from all that's happened in the last few years. That said, this last few months, I must admit that not much has gone particularly wrong. Things have settled into a routine, and I'm finally recovering from 2 years of burnout. That said, my baseline life, taking care of an extremely energetic, nonverbal 8-year-old, and helping my wife with her various health problems, is pretty stressful on its own. Happily, Di's hip surgery in November is paying dividends, and her mobility has massively improved. And we're looking at options to help my daughter going forward. But the real issue here is that, you know, 2 years of constant disasters really put a ding in my reading schedule. And as we just discussed, there's a lot of books to read. And I really think I need to read them before I start writing to do this right. So many times I've, you know, done the reading as I was going and found times where I wanted to, like, go back and edit things. So I want to do this right. And to give you some idea, I started reading these books for the investiture controversy during the pandemic, so I was trying to read ahead. But with everything that went wrong and the need to read other books for the periods we covered in the interim, all that investiture reading got delayed, and I got new books, and so here I am, raring to go to write these episodes, but with only about half the books read. All of which is to say, I am back on the horse. I'm reading and researching as much as I can given the constraints of my lifestyle. I will be back on the writing horse soon. But as always, I promise you that I want to do this right and not necessarily fast. Hopefully you can all understand and appreciate that, and will continue to be patient while I plow through this material. With that, I'll wrap this up. Thank you all again for continuing to listen, and particularly a huge thanks to my saintly patrons. I will have something for you soon. But in the meantime, that's all for this episode of Wittenberg to Westphalia, Wars of the Reformation.
I am made of soft with camel, Sherman P.T.
2017, 16 cloudy.